Here is the legendary Brent Carver with a song by Charles Aznavour, There Is a Time, with the Art of Time Ensemble.
There is a time for spring and for sighing. A time to for crying, a time to dream, and for sweet pretending. And then it seems that suddenly it's ending. But this time there's no time to waste. We know the time we have cannot be replaced. This time let's not hesitate. We know our time is brief, and it cannot wait this time. There is a time for hope and beginning. Time to lose, and a time to for winning, a time to waste on lazy vacations, a time of haste and beautiful temptations. But this time there's no time to waste. We know the time we have cannot be replaced. This time let's not hesitate. We know our time is brief, and it cannot wait this time. There is a time for fame and for glory, a time of pride, and a time to be sorry, a time to drift on wide summer rivers, a time of snow and icicles and shivers. There is a time for autumn and sadness, a time for youth and love's happy madness, a time for dreams and for sweet pretending. And then it seems that suddenly it's ending. But this time, there's no time to waste. We know the time we have cannot be replaced. This time, let's not hesitate. So take my love, my life. It cannot wait this time. Reveal all that living can be, snug as a child in the shelter of my shoulder. And as I hold you, you may start loving me. There is a time for spring and for sighing, a time to laugh, a time to cry, a time for dreams and for sweet pretending. And then it seems that suddenly it's ending. But this time there's no time to waste. We know the time we have cannot be replaced. This time let's not hesitate. So take my love, my life, my eager kiss. This time there's no time to wait. We fade away as fast as the morning mist. This time let's not hesitate. So take my love, my life, my eager kiss. For time close.
name is Marjorie Wingrove, and I'm the host of this show, Death Happens, broadcast through the facilities of Trent Radio, 92.7 CFFF. I've created this show as a way to normalize the conversation around death-related topics. Death is inevitable for every living thing. I believe knowledge and preparation can create some comfort and peace of mind. My guest today is myself. I haven't shared much of my personal story yet, and because it's the anniversary of my mother's death, it feels like a good time to do this. It's been 16 years, so I've had some time to witness my grief morph, transmute. I've explored grief from different perspectives, seeing various aspects of my grief and what that looks like over time. It's not a surprise when my mother dies. She had a diagnosis 8 months previously. She handles her illness with grace and dignity, doing things her way, making decisions for herself. She says she doesn't want to pursue treatment because she doesn't want to be sick while she's dying. This doesn't sit well with some family members, and they try to convince her to try various things, but she sticks to her own plan. She says she's lived a good life, and it feels like it's okay to go. At this point, she's 78. My father has been dead for several years, and my mother has been romantically involved for a couple of years with this wonderful man, Don. They've had a chance to travel together, they've gone to Portugal, and they share a passionate romance. It gives me hope. When my mother was pursuing Don, she asked me for advice on how to get his attention. I guess because I'm good at that. I don't know. I said, I can tell you how to get him, but I can't tell you how to keep him. I don't know that I'm good at that. Anyway, she doesn't really need my help, but she likes my support. In the first couple of months after the prognosis that she's terminally ill, there's a big flood in Peterborough. Mum's basement is wiped out. But of course, the bright side she sees is that there's a lot less stuff to sort through, and it all just goes in the garbage. I'm living in Oakville at the time with my then partner and also my 2-year-old son, Riley. I find part-time daycare for Riley so that I can visit Mum 2 or 3 days a week and help her out. My son seems to understand my need to go away, and he's not fussy about it. He seems supportive, which is an interesting dynamic from a 2-year-old. Plus, he loves daycare. Mum's diagnosis is in May. I'm planning a wedding for October, Thanksgiving weekend. The family has a tradition of going to Camp Kawartha for Thanksgiving weekend. My siblings and their families, we end up having about 24 of us. So in 2004, we rent the camp so that friends can stay over in the cabins for the weekend. It's a great party, catered by the camp staff. I have my belly dance friends come and perform. Some of my family put a band together. My brother-in-law, who's a professional tenor, he sings. And there's nothing like being outdoors in the autumn. There's a lot of hiking, and I think even my nieces and nephews took a dive in Clear Lake. It was a great time. So Mum hasn't told many people that she has cancer. Her bridge club knows. And rather than playing bridge when it's Mum's turn to host, the women have her on the dining room table doing hands-on energy healing. Mum plans a huge party for herself at Irwin Inn on Stony Lake. 85 of her closest friends, not even room for the ones from out of town. Guests keep asking me if it's her birthday, or is she and Don announcing their engagement? My mother says, not in a million years. Anyway, all I can tell them is that she wanted to throw a big party for herself. That's it. When it becomes evident that she's ill and starts needing more help, we organize a circle of care. With some advice from Hospice Peterborough and a book called Circle of Care, there's a meeting set up for volunteers. 50 people show up who want to be put on the schedule to do home visits or help in any way they can. There's a schedule and each person drops by for a couple of hours. Sometimes Mom has no interest or energy to see anyone, so the visitor will just sit in the living room with a book or prepare some food that she might have energy to eat later, maybe laundry. Not even everybody who's on the schedule gets to go and help her because she dies before all the volunteers can help. So during March break, 2005, I'm visiting. My sister, Syl, who lives across the street, is away on a ski trip with her family. And Mum tells me she's going to wait and not die until they come back so that they can have a nice holiday. I say, well, I'm moving at the beginning of April. Can you wait until after we're settled in a bit? She says, no, she can't wait that long. What I've learned in my doula studies is that people have a near-death awareness. They know when they're going to die. They can feel it. So Mom wants to stay at home as long as she can, but her plan is to go to the hospital for palliative care when home care becomes unmanageable. There are times when I'm alone with Mom and her pain is too much, and the amount of morphine I could administer isn't enough. There is nothing during this time of end of life that can't be managed to provide comfort for the dying person, which is something I've learned, but it is often a challenge to know what they require. A week before Easter, Mom says it's time to go to the hospital. Some of my sibs and I take turns staying with her overnight. And I don't know why I feel it necessary to make myself at home at the hospital, but I put on my blue stripy flannel pajamas and I take a toothbrush like I'm having a sleepover. She calls out for people and I don't recognize the names. Someone named Kathy, who I find out later was one of the nurses. Anyway, she also wants her sister Nan, who has booked a flight, but will still be a couple of days and ultimately doesn't make it in time before my mother dies to say goodbye. At one point, Mom tries to get out of bed, and I have to hold her down because she's got a catheter and an IV, and she becomes calm after a bit, and it's okay. And as I sit with her, she tells me my granddad is waiting for her, that he has a suitcase. I picture him in a wool overcoat and fedora, shiny brown shoes, standing in the misty distance. But she's anxious, saying she doesn't have a ticket. I let her know it's okay. She'll get one when she needs it. Now, one thing about Mom, she could always talk her way into things if she forgot her tickets at home. School plays, concerts, you name it, she could talk her way on. Anyway, and the dying will often talk about traveling. This is part of the near-death awareness, along with knowing when they'll go. Another part is seeing loved ones, sometimes visions that look like angels or lights or a beautiful place they want to get to. And this is different from a near-death experience. This is an awareness that they're about to transition. Easter Monday, we hold a brunch at the Holiday Inn for all the people who volunteered in our circle of care. My nephew Steve makes a huge card and everyone there signs it. After brunch, some of my sibs, Ted, Sil, Mary, and my mom's boyfriend, Don, go to the hospital to show her the card and tell her about the brunch. She's still awake and somewhat aware. She loves the card. Don had been chewing on a candy he got on his way out of the Holiday Inn, one of those, like, Sambuca-flavored hard candies. When he kisses my mother, she says, "Oh, I smell licorice," which is great because she loves licorice. That's the last thing I remember her saying. She falls into a coma shortly after. She hasn't eaten for days, maybe over a week. She's still so beautiful. She's wearing pink pajamas covered in big red hearts. Not really in character, but she put them on because she thought my eldest sister, during a visit, this sister had been partially estranged. She thought that she would like to see them, but I don't think my sister even noticed. Mom's been wearing them all week. After Mom dies, I find a spare plastic heart-shaped button in her jewelry box. I still have it. Easter Monday afternoon, my two sisters and my brother, did I mention I come from a family of seven kids? We sit vigil with Mom, Mary wrapped in a prayer shawl. I'm tired from being up with Mom the night before, and I hang on for a little while. I know she's going to die any time, and I don't want to miss that moment. We hold her hands. We sit. We're quiet. I think we're praying. Around 2 a.m., I just can't stay awake anymore. I go to the lounge, and I lie down on a green vinyl couch. I dream about Johnny Carson and Jimmy Smits. I have no idea why. 4 a.m., my brother taps me on the shoulder. I notice one of my sisters has fallen asleep across the room, Sylvia. He wakes her up too. We go into Mom's room. She's dead now. Her mouth is open. Her eyes are closed. Her body is a shell. I can't feel her in the room. I don't yet know how to be with a dead body, even though I've had the experience of lying on the living room floor next to my dad's body several years before. I want to remember everything about my mother in that 1 second. I remember thinking when I was little that it didn't make sense for her face to be so soft and her hands to be rough. She didn't wear gloves to do housework. There was a lot of housework. So I reach out to touch her cheek. I hold her hand. She's so cold. The hair on her cheek is soft downy fuzz, really so soft. But there's no one behind it anymore. I put my cheek against hers, and I'm still not sure if it's okay to do that. I give her a tentative kiss. She was right. She couldn't wait until I moved. The following day, I'm having to do all my real estate dealings, using the fax machine at the funeral home to send my signed forms to the lawyer in Toronto while my siblings and I make arrangements for the funeral. Something that's really great over those next few days as we're dealing with that is the people from the Bridge Club, the women from the Bridge Club, put boxes of food on the front porch at my sister's house with utensils and plates and everything. And we just bring the box inside, gobble it up, and put everything outside, again, dirty and all.
It was such a huge relief. That's such an important thing that somebody can do. So a couple of months before, I was with my mom at the funeral home while she's working on pre-planning. And not long after her death, I start contributing to my own plan, which is paid for now, but not totally arranged. The second day after mom dies is when the hard lesson comes. I learn that people handle grief in ways that are unique to their personalities. I get out of bed after sleeping in. I have some sleep debt to catch up on. I come downstairs and my one sister is cleaning and baking, sure that that's what mom would do to keep busy. My other sister comes boldly through the front door announcing the plan for selling the house. This is way too much for me to handle. I feel like I've been hit with a wrecking ball. I feel like my grief is interrupted. And so it goes for weeks and months afterwards. I feel like I'm not allowed to grieve the way I need to, that how I'm feeling is wrong. I feel that anything I share with my siblings is crazy and out of control. Nothing makes sense without mom alive. Whenever the phone rings, I think it must be her. My mother has been everything to me. She used to say we had a symbiotic relationship. I go through months of feeling like my skin is on fire and is being torn from my body with a fork. I become accident prone, one time having a really terrible fall down the stairs of our new house. I do what I can to function in the day-to-day because I have a 2.5-year-old son. He asks a lot about Gran, and I can tell he's trying to understand my reactions. If we pass a floral shop, he'll say, "That makes me think of Gran," referring to the flowers at the funeral. Oh, something about the funeral. He wants to know where Gran is, because everyone is talking about her, and her photo is at the front of the church. The picture is on the table beside a marble urn. Where's Gran? Riley's favorite book is The Dinosaur Museum. This book also came in handy when Riley felt the cat and asked, "What's he got in him?" Bones. A skeleton. So here's me trying to explain death and cremation to a 2-year-old. I get through it and say, "So what's left of Gran is her bones, and they're in that box." He says, "Can I see him?" I tell him the box doesn't open. So then, how does one entertain a 2-year-old at his grandmother's funeral? Well, we get all the hymn and prayer books in a pile and stack them and then unstack them and then stack them again, and we do that for as long as it takes. And then we go eat crustless egg salad sandwiches. One day I'm unpacking and a piece of paper, a card, falls to the floor. I pick it up and it says, "Welcome to your new home. Love, Mum." It's a card she gave me a few moves ago, and there it is for me to see again. She often leaves me notes. We'd been in the middle of an adoption process, waiting for our second child when Mum dies. We put the process on hold, knowing that it would be too much to deal with. But 11 months after Mum died, we get a call about an expectant birth mother in Peterborough. We're at the hospital for the birth, and then we're able to visit the nursery over the next few days. One day I'm in the hospital cafeteria, and I lose my loony in a vending machine. I have some time to waste before I'm allowed in the nursery, so I ask someone, "How can I get my loony back?" This is where it gets surreal. I have to go down a hall and up the spiral staircase to the old part of the hospital. There's nobody around. I find the window where I'm told someone will help me get my dollar. The thing is, the window slides open, and it opens under someone's desk, like the elevator in Being John Malkovich or some scene from Get Smart. The person on the other side looks under the desk to talk to me. I'm told to fill out my name on the list on the clipboard she hands me. With the pen on a string, I write my name and phone number. Then I freeze. I look at the name, the first name, at the top of the page. It's my mother's signature, Judy Goddard, in her handwriting. I hand the clipboard back and I get a dollar coin in return. I have no proof. This is a time before I have a cell phone. This is a time before I had the presence of mind to say anything to ask if she sees it too. I can only tell you, I saw it. There's a freedom that comes with the death of my mother. I am now the first one in line as the mum. I'm the one who has the skills to make decisions. I'm the matriarch of my little family. I have leveled up in maturity, whether I like it or not. So much time has gone by now. It doesn't hurt that she's not alive. I can still hear her laugh. I can hear her voice. I think I can smell her. Sometimes I eat licorice to feel close to her. She told me that she believed when she died, she would be dead. Nothing would come after that. But I feel her around me all the time. Occasionally, I get a note. Sometimes she orchestrates events in my life and guides my decisions. She's a huge presence in my life. Well, she's still at home and I'm taking care of her in her bedroom. She asks me to massage her belly. Her liver is swollen with cancer. It's painful and it itches. I have lavender-scented oil and I rub it on, gently caressing my mother's skin. It's hard under my hand. And I'm thinking I'm giving comfort to the thing that is killing her. It's like the cancer is a parasite, a beast lying in wait that I have to care for so that it will be kind to her as it takes her from me. Mum tells me we have traded places, that I'm the mother and she's the child. One day a telemarketer calls and asks for Mr. Goddard. I say that he's dead. Then the telemarketer asks to speak to Mrs. Goddard. I let them know there's not much point in talking to her either. Another time I say to Mum, Oh, there's something I was going to ask you, but I forget what it was. She says, well, you better think of it soon. She turns 79 just before she dies, and she tells me, don't let them write that I was in my 80th year. Oh, Mum, this is only the story of her death and some of what it feels like to grieve. The reason I love my mother so much is because of who she was when she was alive, obviously. She's born in 1926. She has a sister, Nan, 4 years younger. Their parents are Judd and Dor. Judd is a bank manager. He plays golf, goes to Woolworth's for a hot dog and a ginger ale. He keeps peppermint lifesavers in his pocket to disguise the fact that he smokes. Not fooling a soul. He likes a rye. Dor is quiet and loving. She has pale blue hair. Mum remembers the D'Anquints. She's a good student, and she's naive. Her first boyfriend is nicknamed Daisy. I'll let you guess why. Mum goes to University of Toronto for occupational therapy. When she's 19, she moves into a rooming house across from the AGO run by the Anglican Church. As it happens, when I'm 19, I live in the same rooming house, but it's changed a bit, eh? Mum knew Dad in high school, but he always seemed out of reach, as he was a bit older and apparently much cooler. They want to get married, but if they do, she'd have to leave university because it's 1947 and married women aren't allowed to go to school, so they elope. Their anniversary is April 4th. Over the summer break, while Mum is living with her parents, a letter comes addressed to Mrs. Goddard, so her mother finds out the truth and urges Judy to go to Kingston, where my dad is at Queen's for engineering. It's seen as my mother's duty to go and look after him. She always carries regret that she hasn't finished her education. At 23, she has her first child. Within 4 years, she has four. 2 years later, another. 2 years later, another. 5 years later, another. Me. I ask if I was an accident. She tells me we were all accidents. She tells me she kept her birth control in a drawer. Fat lot of good it did there. When the first four are in diapers, cloth diapers that have to be washed by hand, my parents rent a farmhouse while they wait for a new house to be built. My mother has to put the four kids in a playpen so she can get anything done. She says sometimes when she opens a kitchen cupboard, a rat would jump out. There's no one for miles. Eventually, Judy goes to teacher's college and then studies to be a medical secretary. She works 17 years for Ralph Hall in the brick house on the west side of the bridge next to Quaker Oats. She and my dad take us camping in the summers. They go on canoe trips, they cross-country ski. At some point, they take up line dancing, wearing Western boots and all. After Dad dies, she falls in love again and enjoys the freedom of a love affair, not having to be responsible for anyone but themselves. Judy Goddard is the most loving, generous, optimistic, humble person ever. And sometimes she looks back at me when I look in the mirror. What would I do differently now that I know what I know from becoming a death doula? Well, I think we did all right. I look back and I wish that medical assistance in dying, MAID, had been an option, even though I don't know if either of my parents would have chosen that. But I think it would have been better than starving to death or going into a coma, maybe. And maybe my father would have chosen that when he was dying with cancer, rather than his choice to die alone by suicide. I think I'm more prepared now to listen to those near-death awareness stories my mother was sharing. Again, I think I did well as it was. And I would have advocated for my little son to see his gran, even though she was in the hospital not looking too much like he might remember her. He wanted to see her and to say goodbye, but I took the advice of someone else to not allow him in. I didn't have enough support as I worked on processing my grief. And if you know me, you know that I am now a proponent of speaking openly about death, dying, and bereavement. I'm a person who processes externally, and I needed more help than I got at the time. However, I got through it, and that's the best a grieving person can get. Here's a song I've wanted to play on the show. It reminds me of being on the lake in the evening, being with my family, camping, or sitting on the dock at the sailing club. This is a song by 2021 Juno nominee Rick Fiennes from his album Solar Powered 2. This song is called One Lone Loon.
One lone loon flies o'er this place, a mournful tune sung same time every day, then just empty space and a twisted pine and a granite lake, a wind-torn sky of mottled gray, bent out of shape so the sun can't shine, and all colors gone. You were not mine for very long, but the love stays strong, and I pray for peace like I know you know. No, not for me. I want her to feel better. I want her to feel whole. One long loon, and it's an eerie sound. Broken hearts shatter silence, empty space with no room found. In the sun, the world goes on, and people run from place to place. They seem to get things done while time stands still. While winter looms, flight needs will, and will can seem doomed. For one lone loon.
Thank you, Rick Fiennes. I just love that song. And now here is Terry Jacks with Seasons in the Sun. Thank you for listening to Death Happens. My name is Marjorie Wingrove.
Goodbye to you, my trusted friend. We've known each other since we were 9 or 10. Together we've climbed hills and trees, learned of love and ABC, and skinned our hearts and skinned our knees. Goodbye, my friend, it's hard to die when all the birds are singing in the sky. Now that the spring is in the air, pretty girls are everywhere. Think of me and I'll be there. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun. But the hills that we climbed were just seasons out of time. Goodbye, Papa, please pray for me. I was the black sheep of the family. You tried to teach me right from wrong. Too much wine and too much song. Wonder how I got along. Goodbye, Papa, it's hard to die when all the birds are singing in the sky. Now that the spring is in the air, little children everywhere. When you see them, I'll be there. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons. Michelle, my little one, you gave me love and helped me find the sun. And every time that I was down, you would always come around and get my feet back on the ground. Goodbye, Michelle, it's hard to die